I think the United States is trying to reconfigure global trade rules so that they do protect U.S. interests.
Asia struggles to stay ahead on trade. It's Monday, November 5th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Hello and welcome. You'll find us on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, ASEAN's traditional topics muted at upcoming summit. Reviving coral reefs with robots. Protecting kids from an annual illness. Women more prominent in U.S. elections. It's all on today's VOA Asia. The massive free trade pact known as the Trans-Pacific Partnership is scheduled to come into force by year's end on December 30th, with six of the original 11 nations under the banner Comprehensive and Progressive Agreement for Trans-Pacific Partnership. The pact once included the United States until President Donald Trump, just days in office, pulled out in January 2017.
米国、すぐに TPP にですね、復帰というのは難しいかもしれませんが、Japan's
economy minister Toshimitsu Motegi said over time he hopes the United States would rejoin the trade regime. Stephen Nagy, senior associate professor in politics and international studies at the International Christian University in Tokyo, tells VOA's Victor Beatty this is not out of step with the current trend toward trade protectionism.
No, the Comprehensive Progressive Trans-Pacific Partnership is a very important trade deal that focuses on protecting intellectual property rights, reducing and trying to eliminate the role of state-owned enterprises in interfering in market economies. It prioritizes very strong environmental and labor laws. All of these are priorities not just for the members that have signed the TPP, but the United States, if you've looked at how it's engaged in the new NAFTA 2.0 deal, many of these have been these principles have been adopted. So the United States is not engaged in protectionists. I think the United States is trying to reconfigure global trade rules so that they do protect U.S. interests, but also it pushes back against some of the economic and trade practices by the Chinese that really infringe upon intellectual property rights and those other areas that I mentioned.
Without the U.S., will this trade regime be enough to deal with China and some of its practices?
Well, the trade regime has been what we call an open agreement. So there will be additional members joining, for example, Thailand, perhaps the U.K., which will increase its economic weight, and it will create a block of countries that's prioritizing intellectual property rights and limiting the role of state-owned enterprises. Importantly, the way this deal has been repackaged, the chapters that included the United States have been pulled out in such a way that they could allow for the United States to come in the future in some kind of reconfigured way. Examining the NAFTA 2.0 agreement really gives us an understanding that the United States also values intellectual property rights protection, preventing the transfers of technologies to non-market-oriented economies, and preventing state-owned enterprises from interfering in the market economy. And as such, I think that there's actually a lot more parallels in the NAFTA 2.0 agreement and this new TPP agreement than usually acknowledged.
Japan's economy minister, Mr. Motegi, said as protectionist moves strengthen across the world, the importance of free and fair rules is growing more and more. He said Japan would continue to be a flag bearer for free trade.
Absolutely. And if you've been following the discussions about the free and open Indo-Pacific concept, one of the key aspects of this is focusing on a rules-based behavior, free and open trade. And this, again, resonates very much with the Japanese prioritization on keeping markets open and engaging in open, non-protectionist trade. But it also resonates very much with the U.S. agenda of creating freer markets, more fair trade, more reciprocation.
Stephen Nagy said the current trade tensions have much to do with reform needed to repair the outmoded World Trade Organization rules that worked when China first joined the WTO, but its economy is now so large those rules no longer apply. The five other members who have yet to ratify the CPTPP include Brunei, Chile, Malaysia, Peru, and Vietnam. These are among some of the top Asia stories you'll find right now on voanews.com. Pompeo resuming nuclear talks with North Korea this week. New Caledonia voters reject independence. Myanmar by-election results a lesson for Suu Kyi's party. Indonesian extends search 3 days for bodies and black box. China seeks to rebrand global image with Import Expo. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on Facebook at VOA Asia. You can also stop by the voanews.com website. Continue with VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Asian Americans are the fastest growing minority group in the United States and are growing in force both as voters and candidates for the midterm elections coming up in just over a day. VOA Asia's Anna Cook spoke with Sono Shah, a researcher at AAPI Data, which publishes demographic data and policy research on Asian Americans. Shah explains the key findings of the research on Asian American voters and how they are likely to vote during the midterms.
We fielded a survey of Asian American registered voters as part of work with AAPI Data. And there's a number of, you know, things that have come out in terms of differences from the previous midterm elections. And see, voter enthusiasm is slightly increased relative to last year. It does look like most Asian Americans are leaning towards Democrats when you ask them about the horse race in the House or the Senate. In general, presidential approval ratings for Donald Trump tend to be on the negative end, the low end.
Are there more Asian American candidates running for Congress this year than any other years?
Yeah, that's what it looks like. So in 2010, we estimated about 16 candidates were running for Congress. That number in 2018 is up to 32. So it's definitely an increase, double the number we've seen in 2010.
So do you think that is what accounted for the voter enthusiasm that's increased this year among Asian Americans?
It's hard to say. I mean, but it's a possibility for sure. I mean, given such a dramatic increase in just where, Asian American candidates are running, it's possible that that's why. Typically we see, the states with large AAPI populations like California, New York, New Jersey, having AAPI candidates running. But now, you're seeing them across the country in places where ordinarily you wouldn't see APIs running. So that, that probably does play a role to some extent.
What kind of values or you see policies are most important to Asian American voters?
We see kind of across the board support for stricter gun laws. That's one thing that we find across ethnic groups that we polled, but also across Asian Americans across party affiliation. So Asian Americans who identify as Republican or Democrat or other, they all in general, support stricter gun laws. Another thing that kind of pops out is support for stricter emissions on power plants to address climate change. And that's one finding that's been consistent across election years. That's something we also saw in our 2016 election survey, and I think 2014 as well.
Do you see that Asian American candidates are, trying to target a wider population instead of trying to target an Asian American population?
Yeah, they kind of have to if they want to be competitive. I mean, that's one difference you notice when you're thinking about the success or the viability of Asian American candidates compared to African American candidates or Latino candidates. A lot of times those candidates come from majority minority districts where Latinos or African Americans make up a majority of the electorate in that district. With Asian Americans, it's a lot different, right? Most Asian Americans are dispersed throughout the United States. So they don't make up a majority anywhere. So kind of by necessity, when Asian American candidates run for office, they have to kind of appeal to a wider electorate. They can't just rely on the Asian American vote to get them elected into office.
Sono Shah, a voting data researcher, speaking with VOA Asia's Anna Cook. This midterm vote Tuesday may have major political implications in the United States. Stay with VOA Asia as later in today's program, we will explore greater roles for women. Happening now in Asia, the Pacific Islands of New Caledonia have voted to remain part of France in an independence referendum. Nearly 57% of the island's 174,000 voters decided to remain part of France, which claimed the archipelago in the mid-19th century. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. Starting out a brand new week on VOA Asia, we're glad you're with us. Asian leaders will be meeting at the U.S.-ASEAN Summit and East Asia Summit in Singapore November 15th. Despite evidence of rising authoritarianism, human rights violations, and regression of democracy in the region, these issues won't be high on the agenda. What is causing this trend, and why is the Trump administration largely silent on it? White House correspondent Patty Whitaker-Suara has this report.
Brutal anti-drugs campaign in the Philippines. A Cambodian opposition figure placed under house arrest. The Thai junta leader aiming for another term as prime minister. And the Vietnamese Communist Party leader taking over as president, amassing power not seen in decades.
There's definitely an increasing trend toward authoritarianism and a significant decrease in freedom in Southeast Asia.
Minorities are under attack, including the Rohingyas, targets of the Burmese military crackdown. Even in normally stable Indonesia, a Christian governor is jailed under a blasphemy law. Some analysts say it reflects a global rise in the politics of fear and division.
A lot of politicians are leaning on those easy ways to whip up support. I think it's playing with fire in every context, and that would be true in the United States and Europe, and that's true in Southeast Asia.
Another factor is the lack of regional pressure to improve human rights, as ASEAN has long held to the principle of non-interference among its members. Analysts also point out to China, which is expanding its influence in the region.
As they do that, they're exporting their own values. And it's a little bit terrifying in light of the fact that China is committing unbelievable, serious human rights violations against its own people.
Over the past decade, China has stepped up trade and investment through its Belt and Road Initiative, nurturing close ties to Southeast Asian elites.
And in some cases, supporting, potentially supporting corruption and things like that. And I think the countries in the region really have to figure out how they handle large amounts of Chinese investment and ensure they're keeping up international standards and protecting the rights of local people.
China denies accusations of abusing human rights and supporting corruption. Meanwhile, the Trump administration has been less willing than its predecessors to call out other countries for their shortcomings.
The United States will not tell you how to live or work or worship.
Throughout his 2017 five-nation trip in Asia, President Donald Trump focused on trade, terrorism, and North Korea's nuclear program, but hardly mentioned human rights.
My sense is that in the overall foreign policy of the Trump administration, that human rights does not have a very high position. So it's not just in the Indo-Pacific region. It is in many places.
The White House disagrees.
We promote human rights all over the world.
U.S. Vice President Mike Pence will be traveling to Singapore in mid-November, where he is expected to highlight U.S. military and economic commitments to the region. Patsy Widakuswara, VOA News at the White House.
Coming up, robotic protection for coral reefs. You're listening to VOA Asia.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
This news from VOA Asia, an Australian nun who angered the Philippine president by joining anti-government protests used her final hours in the country to call on Filipinos to unite and fight human rights abuses. Sister Patricia Ann Fox left the Philippines for Australia after her missionary visa was downgraded to a temporary visitor's visa, which expired Saturday. VOA Asia Facebook never expires. Visit. As VOA Asia continues, for the first time, an underwater robot is to be used to plant baby coral to parts of Australia's Great Barrier Reef damaged by mass bleaching. Scientists plan to collect hundreds of millions of coral spawn off the Queensland city of Cairns in the coming weeks, from Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Most coral reproduce through spawning, where eggs and sperm are pushed into the water at the same time. In northern Australia, researchers are preparing to harvest this mass release of coral spawn on the Great Barrier Reef. They'll be reared into baby corals in floating enclosures. Then they'll be delivered as so-called larval clouds to Vlasov Reef, about an hour's sailing from Cairns, by a semi-autonomous robot. Professor Peter Harrison, the director of the Marine Ecology Research Centre at Southern Cross University, says science is giving nature a helping hand.
What we're trying to do now is to compensate for the loss of corals that would normally provide enough larvae for the system to naturally heal.
Large areas of Australia's Great Barrier Reef have been damaged by severe bleaching, or loss of the algae that gives coral its colour. The bleaching is caused by rising water temperatures and made worse by climate change. The experiment on Vlasov Reef, which was badly affected by the mass bleaching, will be coordinated by divers, who will guide the spawn-spreading robot, known as the Larval Bot. Professor Matthew Dunbabin is from the Queensland University of Technology.
In future projects, we're hoping that we can start to do that more autonomously, but this is very new and we're up against the clock in terms of trying to get this in the field as quick as possible to make sure that we can have a reef to preserve.
A coral reef is made up of millions of tiny animals called coral polyps. The reefs are critical ecosystems and provide a home for at least a quarter of all marine species. The Great Barrier Reef is about the same size as Italy or Japan. 30 species of whales, dolphins and porpoises have been recorded along the reef. It faces a range of threats, from climate change and overfishing, to the runoff of pollution from farms, to coral-eating crown-of-thorn starfish. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
This news alert from VOA Asia, the United States and South Korea are beginning small-scale military drills that were delayed during talks with North Korea days after Pyongyang threatened to restart work on its nuclear program if international pressure does not ease. Find out more when you visit VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, most people associate the flu with cold-like symptoms. They don't realize the flu can lead to life-threatening complications. Close to 80,000 people died in the United States, including 180 children last year, and already this year, a child in Florida has died from the flu. A hospital there did some research and found a significant number of parents are concerned about the safety and effectiveness of the flu vaccine. VOA's Carol Pearson has details.
Careful, Hannah.
Kids are very effective spreaders of disease. Just ask Aaron McMichael.
My husband and I just assume if one kid gets it, it's do the best you can and then hope for the best, because more than likely somebody else in the house will come down with it as well.
Even though kids don't like getting a shot, these kids know why they get one.
All right. It's better to get a shot than get sick.
It helps protect you from the flu, and so when you go to school, your friends don't catch it.
A Florida hospital surveyed parents and found a significant number of parents are misinformed about the vaccine.
Doctors recommend the flu vaccine because we know, based on science and research and facts, that it is the best way to protect yourself and your family against the flu.
The survey found a third of the parents questioned don't think the vaccine works. More than half said children can get the flu from the shot, which is not true.
The parts of the virus that are used are completely dead, so you cannot get the flu from the flu shot.
The survey also found about 28% of parents believe the flu shot can cause autism.
We know that the flu vaccine is safe. You cannot get the flu from the flu vaccine. You cannot get autism from the flu vaccine. It is not a conspiracy for doctors to recommend the flu vaccine.
Scientists try to figure out what strains of flu are likely to circulate in a given year. But even if they guess wrong, the vaccine still offers some protection.
When your body receives the flu vaccine, your body starts to think, okay, I've got to start making antibodies to help protect against the flu virus. So even if it's not a perfect match, getting the flu vaccine will still give your body some protection.
Infectious disease experts recommend getting vaccinated before the flu season begins.
Tell me where I need to hold it.
This goes for adults as well. It protects the people who get vaccinated, as well as babies who are too young to get the vaccine. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
A record number of American women are running and rerunning for political office at all levels of government in the upcoming midterm elections. And they're finding innovative ways to finance their campaigns. VOA's Julie Tabo followed two candidates, a Democrat and a Republican, to see how they're raising funds in their quest to land seats in the U.S. Congress.
We need 23 seats to win back the House.
Deborah Holland is running for Congress. She's the Democratic nominee in New Mexico's 1st Congressional District, hoping to make history by becoming the first Native American woman to serve on Capitol Hill.
If there's any chance that you'd be willing to make another generous donation.
But as all political candidates know, running a campaign takes money, especially for first-time contenders.
It's no secret that you have to raise a lot of money to run a congressional campaign because you really do have to have ads on TV, and TV is expensive.
I'm Deb Holland.
Holland is funding her campaign with lots of small donations coming through the internet, regular mail, and at fundraising events like this one.
I have a lot of donors who will donate $3, $5, $10 apiece. And I'm the Democratic nominee for Congress in New Mexico.
Her most powerful fundraising tool, she says, is her telephone.
Thank you so much. You have a wonderful evening. I have called some people who have said I've never, ever been called by a candidate. Thank you for calling me. I'm so happy to hear from you.
Deb Holland, I'm well. Hi, Phil. Nice to see you.
Since Holland doesn't accept money from corporate political action committees, she also relies on contributions from Native American tribes and through Democratic fundraisers like Emily's List that collect money from individual donors who are interested in a specific issue. Sarah Briner is research director for the Center for Responsive Politics in Washington.
A lot of people who donate to women candidates are interested in getting more women in office, but they're also interested in the policy positions that women politicians tend to hold, particularly things like abortion and other sort of what we might consider traditional women's issues.
Briner emphasizes that most of the campaign donations to women this year are going to Democrats.
This particular cycle, we're seeing the breakdown more along party lines, with Republicans getting less money, Republican women getting practically nothing, and Democrats getting more money from individual donors.
My name is Ami Hober, and I'm running for Congress.
Oh, okay.
But that hasn't stopped Ami Hober, who is also in a contest for a seat in Congress.
Ever since, I've just rolled up my sleeves to get the job done.
After losing to a Democrat in 2016, she's running again as a Republican candidate for Maryland's 6th Congressional District that spans a large part of Northwest Maryland. She's financing her campaign with small and large donations, as well as personal contributions from herself and her husband, Mark Epstein.
Last time I was unknown, I had to prove myself, and at this point, I think I've proven myself very well.
As the political contenders head into their final days of campaigning, they hope to prove that in America, reaching your political goals is possible as long as you have the money to help you win.
All you guys vote for me now.
Julie Tabo, VOA News, Frederick, Maryland.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. You'll find us online on iTunes and SoundCloud, also on VOA Asia Facebook and our website, voanews.com. You'll also find us on the radio. Many great radio stations throughout Asia carry our program, including Chiang Mai University, Radio FM 100 at Chiang Mai University in Thailand. Thanks to everyone who tuned in today. Our program comes to you through the hard work of many great people like director Tracy Carter, engineer Aiden Utku, managing editor Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team. That includes Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, Doug Bernard, Keith Lane, and Anna Cook. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. Have a great day.